are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, November 15th, 2017. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Maren McKenna, author of Big Chicken, the incredible story of how antibiotics created modern agriculture and changed the way the world eats. Also on the program today, bipartisanship wins, and we lose as some Dems join the Republicans in bank deregulation. Meanwhile, turn the page. Senate GOP confirms torture memo writer to general counsel position of the Department of Transportation. Yes, folks, even if you engage in crimes against humanity, there will always be an opportunity for you to rise in your career. And did Gary Cohn just learn yesterday that he's totally full of crap? Meanwhile, rats abandoning the SS Roy Moore. Disrupt J20 trial begins. Facing felonies for protesting. Meanwhile, a military coup in Zimbabwe. Military says no spousal transition here, please. Four people killed in a Northern California shooting spree because it's a weekday. And the Senate tax plan as a stealth ACA repeal and Medicare cuts. Lastly, Dem intros human rights bill for Palestinian children in the House of Representatives. Don't hold your breath, but it's nice to know that at least someone is raising the issue. All this and more on today's program. And yes, ladies and gentlemen. Oh, I should say, welcome back to Jamie.
Big news.
Jamie's back. She can't speak because of her...
Don't push the mute button. Can you hear me? All right. I'm back, benches.
There you go.
Did you say benches or bitches? Is that a thing?
She's not going to be able to cuss at you for a while, effectively, until her...
My mouth's a little funky still. I don't know what I'm saying.
Also, we do have... we were able, and many people heard about the... And we're going to play this later. But I just want to let people know this is coming. We have, of course, the Alabama robocall, wherein a reporter from the Washington Post, supposed one, is basically paying people to say bad things about Roy Moore. It's a robocall that's been sent out. We have secured some of the rough draft versions of this call, which we will be playing later. It's a pretty big coup. That we were able to land these things. So we'll be playing those later in the program.
It's a wider conspiracy than people think.
Yeah, I mean, there was a lot of work that went into these things.
Let's just put it this way. Allahu Akbar.
Right. And we will get to that in a moment. But this moment right here, there was a Wall Street Journal CEO counsel. God knows what it must be like to be sitting in this audience if you're a normal human being. And Gary Cohn was there. He was being interviewed by the Wall Street Journal. And one of the things that this Republican tax bill features are massive cuts in taxes for corporations. I think part of it is also repatriation. We haven't seen all the language, but repatriation of foreign profits as well. And on top of this, of course, it cuts some other taxes. It eliminates the estate tax after, I think, about 6 or 7 years, which is just absurd. And it raises some taxes on some middle-class folks. But the worst of it is the cuts that are associated with this. It's going to wreak havoc on the Affordable Care Act. It cuts Medicare. We can go on and on. And, of course, what's going to happen? And, again, I don't care too much about the deficit one way or another in this instance. But what's going to happen is they're creating the fulcrum in which they will use their leverage with a deficit scare down the road to cut Social Security and Medicare. I mean, that's this is rinse, you know, wash, rinse, repeat is the way this works. But here is a moment which is stunning. And if there was any integrity in anywhere, I mean, I wanted to say sort of like, you know, the Republican Party, and then I stopped myself before I was being ridiculous.
Yeah,
but in the business, you know, media, right? Well, honestly, like there's got to be some small nook and cranny there, which would be, I mean, the idea that there aren't people who have been earnestly promoting this and their jaws aren't dropping at both like Gary Cohn's reaction here and what's going on is so telling. It's a quick clip, so I'm going to set it up properly for you. They're talking about the massive corporate tax cuts that are coming. And this is the Wall Street Journal CEO Council. One of the reporter there asks, I guess maybe it's the editor-in-chief, I'm not sure which guy it is that asked this, of the CEOs sitting in the audience. He wants to take, they're doing one of these things where it's like, you know, the rhetorical version of like, you know, who's here from Jersey, you know, and everybody raising their hand. They're trying to show just how much this corporate tax cut is going to help workers. Because that's the argument they've been trying to make. Now, they had to take down off their own Treasury Department website a document that was produced during the Bush years, which shows that it's not really going to help workers very much at all. So they had to take that down before they got into this tax fight. But here's Gary Cohn getting firsthand confirmation. And his response is, I mean, what do you imagine? If, you know, remember when Alan Greenspan had that moment like, oh, I guess I was wrong in the falling of the financial meltdown.
The intellectual model that I had for how the world works turns out to be wrong. Sorry that I spent my entire career in public life trying to create bubbles and housing meltdowns.
Yes, it turned out I was wrong. Well, this is another.
Andrea Mitchell
this
now.
Is a moment in real time for Gary Cohn to realize this, and wait till you see how he reacts to it. But here's the question. They're going to ask me, raise hands. Who's going to take that tax money and reinvest it in your company and your workers?
Can I ask you all a quick question? If the tax reform bill goes through, do you plan to increase investment, your company's investment, capital investment? Just a show of hands, the tax reform goes through? Okay.
Why aren't the other hands up?
John, I've got a question for Gary quickly.
Yeah, okay. Why aren't the other hands up? In other words, why is there only two or three people in this entire room full of CEOs who say they're going to put the money back into their company and expand? And Gary Cohn's response is like, wait, why are all my assumptions completely wrong?
We should have coordinated this before. You're supposed to protect.
Well, no. I think this is actually a genuine moment of like, wait, what? And he laughs it off, and they ask him another question. They all just pretend like, you know, this is a moment where they are so convinced of their own assumptions that they're going to see all these hands up, and all they can say is like, are people shy? Oh, it must be people are shy. And the reason why they're not going to invest in their company, in fact, what they're going to do is they're going to buy back shares of their own stocks, or they're going to pay out dividends to their shareholders, is because every person sitting in that room who is in the C-suite of their corporation, their compensation is tied to the stock price of their company. And if that stock price goes up, they're going to get more money. That is not a function of investing in the company for the next 5 years. It's not a function of hiring more workers. You don't do that unless there's demand. And getting more money back on your taxes doesn't impact demand whatsoever. In fact, it's actually the opposite. It's a little bit of circuitous route to make it to the opposite. But because that money is not going to be spent by the government, because that money is not going to your workers, you're going to see less demand than you would have otherwise. Because the only way you're going to get demand is to pay your workers more. But these guys are sitting there going like, what? You got to be joking. No, you're giving us money and you're asking us, oh, am I going to give it to the company or am I going to put it in my pocket? That's a joke, right, Gary Cohn? Right? That's a joke. Now, maybe he doesn't understand this because he came from the world of finance and he only gets the benefit. He doesn't, like, he just sees, like, tax cuts. Oh, I'm going to get more money, not just because I'm getting personal tax cuts, but because the stock's prices are going to go up, and that's my business. It was a really telling moment that really, I mean, honestly, that should be the first thing that people show on the news tonight. Not going to happen.
Caviar and whores? No. No. Where are the hands?
Where are the hands? He's having a tough break. He doesn't get the Fed, and he finds out that everything he believed about everything was wrong.
No strip clubs in Lower Manhattan, and my Rebbe's mad at me, and no Fed.
That's right.
This is a mashuk at the
all end. This for supporting neo-fascists. Folks, here's something else you can chew on at this moment. Many recent studies suggest that having good oral health impacts your overall health. In fact, we've known this for a long time. We had, I think it was, I don't know, several months ago, we had about dental insurance and the implications of good dental hygiene. I've told you guys that, I don't know what it was, about 2 or 3 years ago, I had an epiphany and I was like, I don't want to spend major money in the coming years on my teeth. So I started to brush with an electric toothbrush, and I've been bouncing around at different ones, and I have found the one that I love. Most of us don't brush our teeth properly. I've talked to you about that. But you can start brushing better today. Quip. It's a new company. It's refreshing the way people brush their teeth. It's starting at just $25. Quip is an electric toothbrush that packs premium vibration and timer features into an ultra-slim design that's half the cost of bulkier brushes. In the past, whenever I have not used an electric toothbrush, it's because it is a pain in the ass to keep on your sink. It is a pain in the ass to travel with, impossible to travel with. And the most important thing about brushing your teeth is doing it correctly and doing it. The design of this brush is amazing. It's basically the size of a regular brush. But it has vibrations that you can feel the difference. And this is, you know, look, they'll tell you, use this toothpaste and whatnot. And I'm going off script here. I don't know, because these guys provide toothpaste. It's nice. Freshens your breath. That's great. Yeah, that's the big lie. It's not the toothpaste. It's the brush. And it's the brushing action. You're scrubbing your teeth. I hope I don't get in trouble for saying that. These guys are selling toothbrushes, so they don't care about that. You can even subscribe to receive new brush heads on a dentist-recommended 3-month plan for just $5, including free shipping. You have to see it and brush with it for yourself. It's backed by leading dentists. It was named one of Time Magazine's best inventions of 2016. They won a GQ Grooming Award and made it to Oprah's 2017 O-List.
One of your aspirations.
I got news for you, folks. That's all well and good, but it made the S list too. The Sam list. Right now, you can go to getquip.com/majority. That's getquip.com/majority to get your first refill pack free with a Quip electric toothbrush. That's your first refill pack free at getquip.com/majority. GETQIP.com/majority. Seriously, folks, do yourself a favor. Save your teeth. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Maren McKenna.
You always say you had me.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome Maren McKenna. She is a senior fellow at the Schuster Institute in Brandeis University, a journalist who covers public policy issues, and of course, author of Big Chicken, the incredible story of how antibiotics created modern agriculture, changed the way the world eats. Welcome to the program, Maren.
Thank you for having me.
So, well, give us a sense of what chicken was like in the pre-antibiotic days. I mean, it wasn't even really a staple of at least Americans' diets.
That's true. I mean, of course, none of us were around, but I think our grandparents or great-grandparents would have testified that they had chickens out the back door or on the small family farm all the time. But those chickens were there mostly to produce eggs, and were mostly eaten after they were done with their egg production. So they were older, and they were scrawnier, and they were something that you ate only once in a while. But then chicken got transformed. The chickens that we eat today look nothing like and taste nothing like those chickens of our grandparents' time, and they were transformed by intensive breeding and by precision nutrition and by our desire to eat protein a lot more often, and I think more than anything because of routine use of antibiotics.
All right. Well, before we get to the antibiotics, like, what was it that was there a specific jump in demand? Was there some type of push because someone saw some profit here? What was it? What was it that I guess was the catalyst for that change?
I think you put your finger on it when you said profit. There's a really interesting history in chicken in which time and time again, various kinds of innovation sort of cluster around poultry production, and the supply of chicken actually gets out in front of the demand for chicken. And so periodically there are these transformations in which the poultry industry has to convince people to eat more chicken. And they did it in a number of ways, but the main way they did it, aside from antibiotic use, was by transforming the way chickens look, so that those chickens of our grandparents' time would have been sort of upright, and they would have exercised, they would have run around the barnyard and flapped up into trees, and they would have been kind of slender, and they would have had colored feathers. And now the chickens we eat today are rotund and placid and white feathered, and they have very big breasts, and they're very sort of tippy when they stand up, and they're just nothing like chickens as chickens evolved to be.
And what was the primary source of protein in American diets when chicken it sort of came onto the scene as a primary source of protein?
So people really used to eat much more beef. And you can pinpoint when chicken starts to become, as it is now, the meat that we eat more than any other with a lot of precision. It dates back to 1977, to the first government guidelines on what Americans should eat, what we now call the Dietary Guidelines for Americans. In 1977, the government says Americans should eat less saturated fat, and that is almost universally interpreted as we should eat less red meat and we should eat more white meat, essentially. And from that year, you can see the demand curve take off. That's the first year in which people eat more chicken than they do beef, and it goes up and up and up every year as beef goes down and down.
That's fascinating. Is that and obviously we're going to go back in time to where antibiotics comes into this, but it was in the early 70s. I think it was like around 72. It was under the Nixon administration where we changed our policy about corn, and we started subsidizing corn significantly, which drove I know like beef production. Did it also impact chicken production?
So chickens are, you know, those chickens of the barnyard, the chickens of our grandparents and great-grandparents' time, they would have been feeding themselves for the most part, running around outside, scratching up bugs and insects and so forth. And then we brought them inside and we started feeding them grains. And corn is one of the chief components of chicken feed. So the more you make corn affordable and easily accessible. And the more you expand the production of corn, the more you can expand inexpensively the production of the proteins that are fed on corn.
All right. So let's go back to the introduction of antibiotics and into chicken, and then I guess ultimately into livestock from there. I mean, where was it first introduced?
It's a really fascinating story, and I feel like it was kind of lost to history. It certainly wasn't something I knew all the details of. And to understand how this happened, how we got to the point where antibiotics are routinely added to the diets of livestock all over the world, not just chickens, but pigs and cattle as well, you have to go back to the end of World War II, where two things happen at once. The first is that antibiotics come on the scene for use in human medicine. Penicillin only arrives on the battlefields of World War II in about 1943, and then there are other antibiotics that follow along soon after that. And the second is that at the end of the war, the entire system of food production feels really fragile and uncertain because of the war's damage and because of the necessity to cut costs after the guaranteed market of all those soldiers and sailors needing to be fed goes away. And so the antibiotic manufacturers start looking for other uses for their new drugs at the same time that the food production system starts looking for cheap supplements to make the cheap feed they're starting to use more nutritious. And into that collision of those two trends walks one scientist, a man named Thomas Jukes, who decides to try one of the new antibiotics as a feed supplement for chickens. And the chickens get fat faster than they would have otherwise. And from that one experiment at the end of 1948 emerges an industry that you know, within 5 years of his first trial, American farmers are giving their livestock, starting with chicken, 500,000 pounds of antibiotics a year. And now in the United States, in the most recent federal data, it's 34 million pounds.
Wow. Now, I mean, the thing that you write that I think people don't understand is, I mean, I think we all perceive antibiotics as being something that is produced for people, and that animals get it as an ancillary to the production of antibiotics for people. But it's sort of flipped, isn't it?
That's exactly right. And that was the thing that really made me want to investigate this use of antibiotics in animals, is that I came at this as someone writing about public health, aware of antibiotic resistance as a profound health threat to people, and hearing public health authorities like the director of the CDC saying we have to conserve antibiotics, we have to protect their action, use them very carefully. And then I turned around, and in agriculture, vast amounts, tons and tons of antibiotics were being given to animals that were not sick, were being given for reasons other than to cure infections. And that was so counter to what I was hearing from the medical side that I had to figure out what was going on.
How do antibiotics make a chicken? I mean, how does antibiotics make a chicken fatter?
How does it work? Right. So there's two ways that we use antibiotics in animals, and three ways really, and some of them are easier to understand than others. So first, in a few animals, we use them actually to cure infections, and that's just the way we use them in humans. Then we use them sort of prophylactically to prevent animals getting sick. And then there's this growth promotion, this thing that dates back to 1948. Those antibiotics are given in feed and water, and they go into the animal's guts. They affect the mix of bacteria that live in the guts of animals and in every living thing, including us, in such a way that they change how the animals take nutrients out of their diet. And they speed up their metabolism, speed up the ways in which they put on the tasty muscle that we want to eat. But at the same time, they're also encouraging the emergence and the growth of antibiotic-resistant bacteria in those guts. And that's where the problem, the larger threat to human health, emerges from this routine antibiotic use.
Now, Jukes, you write, never ever really came to accept that there was anything but good coming from pouring these antibiotics into chickens. Is that right?
It's as far as I can tell, to the end of his life. He died in the 90s. He ferociously defended this as a way to feed the world inexpensively. And Jukes is a really interesting guy because throughout the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, he was what we'd think of as a very modern science communicator. He didn't just do science that was published in scientific journals. He wrote op-eds all over the place, including in the New York Times, and relentlessly defended this use of antibiotics as the thing that was going to feed the world.
What was his relationship with antibiotic manufacturers? Just out of curiosity.
Well, well, he worked for one. The reason why he was able to do that first experiment in 1948 was that he was on the staff of one of the first companies making antibiotics, which was a company that at the time was called Letterly Laboratories. It was just outside New York City, and it belonged to a larger company that had emerged from after World War II called American Cyanamid. So he took his own company's drug, the leftovers from making his company's drug, which was called chlortetracycline or oreomycin, and that's what he fed to the chickens in that experiment. And it's really fascinating in some of the paperwork that goes back to the 40s. He records that some of the other scientists in his company asked him not to do this and asked the company not to start selling antibiotics in the way that they were, which pretty quickly was by the tank car load. And he and his boss went ahead because they said competition was right on our heels.
Why did those? I mean, this is actually I was getting to this, and I think I might be a little bit jaded for the amount of time that I spend with tort lawyers. But what and product liability lawyers? What did those other scientists say at that time?
They were veterinarians, and they said this is going to create antibiotic resistance in the animals that you're going to be feeding the antibiotics to, and the results of that are unpredictable. And they had good reason to believe that, because just a few years earlier, Alexander Fleming, the scientist who found penicillin, warned in 1945, when he was accepting the Nobel Prize, that if we did not conserve antibiotics and use them very carefully, antibiotic resistance would result. Now, he was talking about misusing them
in humans.
Medicine, in humans. But the way he describes what might happen, he talks about someone going to the pharmacy and buying penicillin and dosing himself and underdosing himself. He was describing, without knowing it, exactly what was going to happen in agriculture, where animals would receive these tiny doses, too small to cure an infection, that would nevertheless exert an effect on the bacteria in their systems and cause resistance to emerge.
Let's talk about Reimart, is it Ravenholt in Seattle? Because this is where we get a notion of this. And also discuss, I don't have it in front of me, that process.
Acronizing. So yes. Yeah, so this is you know, once a process starts to become profitable, you sort of know how it's going to go, right? So the company that started this whole business of growth promotion, Letterly Laboratories, for which Thomas Jukes worked, which made the drug chlortetracycline or oreomycin, they apparently got the idea that if they were selling their drug all over the country for use in living animals, and they got the idea, what if we were able to sell one more dose after the animals were dead? And they patented a process and sold it to slaughterhouses all over the country by which chicken and later fish that had been butchered and disassembled was dipped in a solution of antibiotics and then packaged for sale. And the idea was that this antibiotic staying on the meat, on the raw meat, would delay the growth of the bacteria that caused spoilage so that a package of raw meat could sit in a grocery cold case for weeks instead of for days. And as with so many things in this story, they had good intentions. They wanted to save food from being wasted, but there were unintended consequences. And Reimart Ravenholt, the gentleman you mentioned, this physician who still is alive in his 90s in Seattle in the mid-1950s as one of the first disease detectives at the Centers for Disease Control, noticed that there was an outbreak spreading among slaughterhouse workers in Seattle of really gruesome skin infections on their arms and hands. And it turned out that they were handling chickens that had already been fed antibiotics in this process in the slaughterhouse in which they were being dipped in more antibiotics. These men had superbug infections, and the superbugs had emerged from the bacteria in the chickens being exposed to antibiotics and then not killed by that antibiotic bath because they were already resistant.
Oh, God. And so it wasn't necessarily a problem with the bath. It was just that in the course of handling it that much, it exposed what was going on in terms of the resistance.
Well, in that particular case, in that outbreak that Ravenholt investigated, the problem was that the bath exposed what was going on, that these superbugs were existing and getting ramped up. But the antibiotic bath itself, that was a problem because it was another way of putting an untrammeled, uncontrolled amount of antibiotics out into the world.
And so when did that, please tell me that practice has ended.
It's over, that's right, yeah. It lasted until the late 1960s, and then what happens is it's not so much that anyone says specifically acronizing, as they called it, has got to go. It's more that in the late 1960s, society as a whole starts to become suspicious of food additives of all kinds, like artificial sweeteners and hormones in cattle. There's a whole sort of the beginnings of a citizen movement around that. And as part of that, people start questioning what's going on in their chicken. And it's fascinating. I went back into a lot of old newspapers and read letters to the editor and grocery store ads and so forth. And the grocery store ads for several years boasted in their fine print, "We have acronized chicken." And then there's a certain point where it turns to, "Our chicken is not acronized," because people are writing into their local papers saying, "Well, we don't know what's going on in our chicken, and that doesn't make us very comfortable, and we think the chicken producer should stop."
Interesting. And who was, like, I mean, where, what were the entity? Was it just magazine writers are writing about this? Was there, you write about Will Harris. Were there other, tell us about Will Harris, if there's others.
Oh, Will Harris is one of my modern day heroes. So it's, there have always been people who've held themselves apart from the whole process of using antibiotics in the raising of livestock, which is a thing that continues up to the present day, though in the United States it has started to change. It started to change in January this year thanks to regulations that were put in by the Obama administration just before they left. But Will Harris, a great man, is the proprietor of a fourth, now fifth generation, family farm in southwest Georgia. His father grew their family farm up into a big cow-calf operation using hormones and antibiotics and pesticides and herbicides. And Will, in his 40s, after he'd taken over the farm, decided that was not the way to go. And now he runs a property that is fully antibiotic-free, fully organic, has 10 species on it, has beautiful green rolling pastures, has its own USDA-approved slaughterhouses, and it's profitable, and it shows that there's another way to take meat production that doesn't involve routine antibiotic use.
Well, let's talk about the public policy changes, because it seems like the Obama administration was able to do something that hadn't been done for 30, or there was attempts to do for 30, maybe 40 years? Is that right?
That's right. In the Carter administration, when Jimmy Carter brought his young crew of reformers into the White House in 1976, one of the things they had their eyes on was what was going on at the FDA, and the FDA had given the approvals for using antibiotics routinely in agriculture. And so Carter's new FDA commissioner, a doctor named Donald Kennedy, a PhD named Donald Kennedy, proposed that he was going to take away the licenses that the FDA had granted in the 50s for using antibiotics in this manner. And he told the drug manufacturers that he was going to hold a set of hearings, and they would have to show up and prove that their drugs were safe. And if they couldn't, he was going to yank the licenses. And he never got to hold that hearing because a powerful congressman from Mississippi who had oversight over the FDA's budget told the White House that if Kennedy went ahead moving against antibiotics, this congressman, Jamie Whitten, would hold the FDA's entire budget hostage. And so the Carter White House forced Kennedy to back off, and he only stayed in government service maybe another 2 years, and then he later on became the president of Stanford University. And thus a stalemate was created between the FDA and veterinary pharma and the large animal production groups that lasted, as you say, more than 30 years until in 2013, the Obama administration announced that they were going to try again. And, you know, a number of things had happened. That very long-serving congressman had finally retired. The public policy was changing. Consumers were thinking differently about the use of antibiotics in the meat they buy. And so the Obama administration was successful. And they put in regulations. Technically, they're called guidances. They're not regulations with the force of law. That on January 1st of this year, growth promoter antibiotics are no longer used in the United States, and if producers use any other antibiotics in any other form, they're supposed to be supervised by a veterinarian, which didn't used to be the case. It used to be they could just walk down to a farm supply store and buy a bag of antibiotics and use it with no oversight, and now they can't do that anymore.
So in the interim, we should say that the practice of using antibiotics this way migrated from chickens into beef, I guess.
Into most meat animals. In fact, went from chickens kind of taught the rest of animal agriculture how to misuse antibiotics. Fairly quickly, it was picked up by pigs at the Hormel Institute, run by the people who brought you Spam. And then that same practice moved into cattle. So there actually are some fairly significant poultry companies now turning against antibiotic use on their own. Actually, they started in advance of the Obama administration rules. So it's kind of interesting to me that the chicken which taught agriculture how to misuse antibiotics might provide the model to help agriculture move away from that historic mistake.
Does antibiotics, it seems to me, clearly was, I guess, provided the mechanism to make livestock agriculture much more of a manufacturing process.
Right. I think that's right.
Is this rolling back? I mean, are people having to, in the absence of being able to just sort of casually provide antibiotics, is that going to force our meat producing industries to be less factory-based in some fashion, or no?
Well, you know, it depends on what you mean by factory-based. I think you're right that in my view, once we started using antibiotics routinely in livestock, that was the foundation for everything that we think of as big industrial-scale farming now, you know, moving animals through very fast, putting them in very large concentrations, cutting costs as much as possible and sort of pushing the externalities of those costs of pollution, of resistant bacteria, and so forth, out from the central business model of meat production. But some of the companies that now are moving against antibiotic use, that the leader of which is Purdue, the Purdue Farms, the big chicken producer, fourth largest in the country, they're showing that they can take antibiotics out of the system and not fundamentally change their system. So if what we still want is very rapidly produced, very industrial scale, very inexpensive protein, we can have it without antibiotics. I think what's promising, though, is that there are small and medium-sized producers, like the folks with the grass-fed farm that we were just talking about in South Georgia, who might never have been able to compete in the marketplace just on the basis of cost, because small and medium-sized production is more labor-intensive.
Right.
But they can compete on being antibiotic-free. It gives them something else to compete on that when they couldn't compete just on price. And so this move, even though it's a move by the big companies, it's really fascinating to me that it might open up the market again for small and medium-sized companies too.
I was going to ask, what are the implications for in terms of the monopolies that we have increasingly in agriculture? And I guess maybe you've answered that question, that this just opens up it sounds a little bit boutique-y to me in that regard.
Well, companies are, some are small. Some are small, you know, beautiful, rolling, green hill, grass-fed farms. But there are also medium-sized companies that are producing mostly chicken, some other poultry, and increasingly some other forms of protein as well, in ways that look like the bigger companies. They have lots of birds at a time. They're in solid-walled barns. You know, they don't have big green rolling hills, but they before did not have the scale to compete with the very large companies. And I think if you bring going antibiotic-free and increasing animal welfare back in as a thing you can, as a value you can sell on, right, then it changes the shape of it, changes the point of entry into the market. That's important because, I mean, let's be realistic about this. Really large-scale protein production, growing at scale, chickens and hogs and cattle, that's never going to go away. It's especially not going to go away now that the economies of the third world are developing, are growing, and their citizens are wanting to eat more meat. I mean, that's a very reliable signal of an economy growing. So India and China and places like that are going to turn to the very intensive meat agriculture that we developed in the United States. Mm. And our best hope for keeping that from creating an even worse international epidemic of antibiotic resistance is to be able to show that you can do that kind of intensive meat production, but not have to make antibiotics part of the mix.
And we should just note that there's a whole host of other reasons why we would want to minimize meat production, particularly in terms of you know, anywhere from a sense of humanity and to what it does to the environment. But this is in this sort of, I guess, narrow policy sphere, which is not so narrow. We need antibiotics to be effective.
But you're absolutely right that there are so many other implications to this, from changing animal welfare to reducing air pollution, water pollution, to changing labor relations around very large meat corporations, to changing land use policies. But routine antibiotic use to this point has underpinned all of that. And maybe if we dismantle that, maybe then those other things get to be reconsidered as well.
I'm curious, just lastly, has there been pushback from the companies that make these antibiotics? I mean, I would imagine these are huge, huge businesses.
So this is a really interesting question to me, because when the Obama administration put in these rules, the way that they made them work was not to tell farmers what they couldn't use. They actually asked the pharma companies to change their labels in such a way that antibiotics could no longer be used off-label. They couldn't be used as growth promoters. So two things are going on there. First, there's still a lot of preventive use of antibiotics, that sort of middle category of use of protecting animals against the conditions of being held in close confinement. That's still fully legal all over the world, even though the World Health Organization just last week came out and recommended that it be stopped. So that's a big market. But also, until the developing economies, India and China and so forth, until they turn away from antibiotic use, that's a massive market. So maybe the drug companies are willing to give up on the West because they see so much promise in the market of the developing world. I think we have to wait and see.
That sounds a lot like tobacco.
Doesn't it, Jeff?
Maren McKenna, thank you so much for your time today. The book is Big Chicken, The Incredible Story of How Antibiotics Created Modern Agriculture and Changed the Way the World Eats. We will put a link to that at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. Head into the fun half. We have some news. We did some, probably for the first time around here ever, threw some shoe leather down and uncovered these early drafts of the real robocall. Of the fake Lenny Bernstein calling in. Man, you know, that is what you do when you lose Sean Hannity. That's where you are, basically.
You have 24 hours.
To prove you're not a pedophile.
We're going to, that's right, Sean Hannity.
Once you lose, how many was it, 5 advertisers? I don't know what the number was, but Hannity flipped from like 15 years old to like, you better prove in 24 hours.
Keurig is not, oh, wait a second.
Sorry.
Yeah, smash your Keurig. Wait, another one pulled? You know what? You better prove that you were banned from that mall for legitimate reasons.
I think it was when Volvo pulled out and they realized, like, nobody's going to be smashing their Volvos. I saw that and I was like, yes, I would love to see that boycott of Volvos, and we'll just swoop right in, pick up some cheap used Volvos. And then we sell them. I mean, I had a whole plan. We were going to swoop in, buy all these used Volvos, sell them to our audience.
And then that way more money.
Oh, yeah. We become basically a podcast, a front for a used car dealership.
Who was that Republican? We didn't use it, but there was a young Republican who I said looked like an attorney for a used car dealership. And we were going to create a whole.
What is that? What is an attorney for a used car dealership? That's you would have had to have seen
that guy's picture in order to get what I was saying. Yes, Jamie.
Liberals do love Volvos.
I was going to say. Ooh, I was waiting for the Birkenstock. Yeah. I was waiting for the Birkenstock.
They were like, wait, Sean. It's all right. We need to call a truce. Don't hurt those beautiful cars.
No, that's my point. They can't. What are they going to do? They're not going to smash them. They're going to sell them. They're going to sell their Volvos at a low price.
Oh, I don't think they're going to smash them. I think if they were real, genuine Trump's America people, they would smash the Volvos. I would think it's a little sad.
I mean, would they have Volvos in the first place?
I don't know.
Some conservative. I guess if Volvo's advertising on Hannity, then they must.
Swoop in and Michael could get a bunch of like half-drunk bottles of Chablis.
Yo, I love it.
Chardonnay.
Yeah, sure.
As they started to get rid of that
half-drunk bottles of Chardonnay.
Well,
or Chablis.
Maybe they just have them at...
makes total sense.
Maybe they haven't opened them yet. Folks.
Oh, yeah, that's good.
We're going to head into the fun half. I got an announcement about tomorrow's program. Now, look. Not every year. I don't think this happened last year. But just about many, many years of the... Oh, holy cow, too. Friday is our anniversary, I think. I mean, there's so many anniversaries with the show. Friday is the anniversary of the hard launch of the podcast. We had a soft launch that I think was like 7 years ago, 5 days ago. I don't know. But the 17th is what we marked, and that's when we did the 12-hour... I did a 12-hour marathon. You weren't here for that, Michael, were you?
No. Mm-mm.
I was... Kyle wanted me to do a full 24, but then I was like, well, yeah, but who's going to operate the board at that point? Everybody's going to pass
out.
It's
all both.
But I don't even remember who did the board then. I think Matt did.
Was it? I don't know.
I don't know. I don't remember. I think it was Matt. But it was also happened to be a day when Occupy was... getting booted out of Zuccotti, or I can't remember exactly. Or it was a year celebration from when, from taking Zuccotti. I couldn't remember. And so it actually, just coincidentally, was a good day because we had people on the streets calling in. I don't know if we're going to do anything like that again Friday. But I guess
I think we're going to do a standard show and say thank you.
The bigger point was that generally we do this the last day before Thanksgiving. But last year, she couldn't do it at this time. And so I said, I gave her a choice of like a week before Thanksgiving. Janine is going to come in. Janine Garofalo is going to come in. As you know, this show first launched as a program on Air America, and Janine and I co-hosted it. And we used to have a dad on who was a Fox-loving right-winger. We actually had Gore Vidal try and talk him down. We had Wesley Clark try and talk him down. None of it worked. And so we got into this habit of basically helping people if you're heading home and you have right-wingers at your Thanksgiving table, giving people advice. So Janine's going to come
in. That is amazing that he had like a NATO general.
Yeah.
One of the most respected, right? Like this guy got a personally curated education. Yeah. Gore Vidal, and he's all just like, yeah, no, I see what you're saying, young man, but you know, free markets. That would be like, so awesome. Did he talk to Gore Vidal the same way he would like an annoying college student?
No,
like,
no.
I understand you're very idealistic, young man, but I think there's a little thing called the free market.
He wasn't quite that obnoxious about it. He was actually pretty good about it. And there was somebody else we had too that was just like sort of mind-blowing. But
you should hook him up with Redneck Revolt this time. See how that works.
Yeah, he's not that. He's kinda, more of like a business guy. A business guy.
Oh, I can't help then.
But Janine is coming in tomorrow. We're doing the show tomorrow. So as opposed to, let's say, Wednesday or Tuesday of next week. So Janine is going to be in tomorrow. We're going to take your phone calls. We're going to take your IMs. We'll talk a little bit about the news. We'll also talk about, I don't know what else we'll talk about. Who knows? So tomorrow on the program, Janine Garofalo, ladies and gentlemen. Friday, we're going to be doing an early show again, starting at 11. Doesn't matter if you just listen as a podcast. Judy Gold is going to join us. The survey, I think, is going to be open for certainly no longer than next week, the middle of next week before Thanksgiving. So if you have yet to take the survey, head to majoritysurvey.com, majoritysurvey.com. If you are a member, click on I'm a member. That is, if you have a subscription to the member show. If you are a freebier, we need your feedback. If you are a YouTuber, we need your feedback. Check it out there. Also, don't forget, you can become a member of this program by going to jointhemajorityreport.com, jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. And if you're, it's a good gift. Oh, and also, you can give a gift. If you go to jointhemajorityreport.com, I think it is. I think you go to Cuck Nation. Isn't it cucknation.org? Is that what it was?
So I got to check. I can't believe that's still up.
Yes. If you go to cucknation.org, you can send the Majority Report membership as a gift. I don't know who did that, but honestly.
Somebody brilliant.
So cucknation.org, you want to send the program as a gift? It makes a great holiday gift, folks. Cucknation.org. Also, check out TMBS from last night. Sarah Jones was on. Ben Mankiewicz.
And then for post-game, Bhaskar Sunkara from Jacobin joined Sarah and I.
And we're going to work on... we already improved your camera shot here, but Sarah Jones, you could not even. She just looked like a microphone.
Yeah, well, I think it improved a bit, but she was slouching a bit.
She was slouching. It was also the microphone.
It was the massive microphone crane.
Yeah. We're gonna have to do something about that.
It's true.
All right, folks, gonna take a quick break. Head into the fun app. 646-257-3920 is the number.